Another missile test by North Korea. Four long-range cruise missiles were fired. A repeated scenario in response to U.S. joint war games. But is this time different? North Korea says it is. And the U.S. and its regional allies believe these missiles are being developed with the intent to arm them with nuclear warheads. In this edition of the program, we will look at why the U.S. is ramping up military pressure instead of diplomatic overtures on Pyongyang, and why it is content in doing that, knowing that North Korean missiles are capable of reaching the U.S. mainland. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review joins us from Leesburg. Jim Cavan, a political analyst and blogger, joins us from New York. To welcome you both, and William Jones, let me first start with you. First, get your reaction on the missiles that were fired. We're looking at four long-range cruise missiles. The question is whether this time is different based on how the capabilities, as it was reported, it said these were strategic cruise missiles designed to demonstrate its ability to conduct a nuclear counterattack. The key word being counterattack here, I think. So do you deem this to be different than the previous missile launches?
Well, they're obviously improving their capabilities here. Reports have it that some of the missiles had made a oval and even a double eight maneuver, showing that there is a greater maneuverability in these missiles. And, of course, they're reaching now to almost 2,000 kilometers. It's really a serious upgrade on the part of North Korea. And as the situation becomes more tense, directly after the maneuvers between Japan, South Korea, and the U.S., where the U.S. is doing significant upgrading in the Asia-Pacific region generally, aimed at North Korea, but also against China, this has created a great deal of tension where the North Koreans typically react by trying to show some of their capabilities. So I think there is an increased tension, there's an increased capability that North Korea is now showing. But I think they're doing it in a context in which the tensions are being fed by U.S. policy in the region, which is increasingly more pushing the military rather than diplomatic solution to the problem, especially the problems with the DPRK.
So you're seeing a relationship there between the U.S. militaristic approach towards the region and the number of missiles or the times the missiles are being launched by North Korea?
Well, sure. I'm sure they are trying to utilize the maximum capability that they actually have there. I think this probably would not have occurred had the maneuvers not taken place. And the maneuvers, of course, are directly aimed at at North Korea and have been criticized by North Korea prior to their being held in the area, so that it was a direct affront, I think they felt, to their attempt to maintain some kind of stability in the region. And they're reacting in the way that DPR always reacts.
Jim Cavanaugh, taking a look at the joint war games that was reported on this between the U.S. and South Korea, what was different about this is the fact that it was held in Washington, basically they called it a tabletop exercise, which focused on, I guess, hypothetical scenarios of which North Korea would use nuclear weapons. And this was the first of its sort under the South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol. Is that what is that indicative of, or what does that show, that it was practiced in the U.S.?
I'm not sure that shows very much. The United States and South Korea have engaged in real military exercises, and that's what really annoys the North Koreans. It was a tabletop exercise in Washington. Of course, it's presented as a defensive exercise, but of course, even in the middle of a defensive exercise, they're going to plan for an invasion of North Korea, and North Korea knows that. So it's just the fact of the military cooperation and the tight military cooperation between South Korea and the United States going to Washington to do these exercises that has North Korea on edge. Look, everybody has to understand the history of the Korean War, which is kind of a forgotten war. That was a vicious war. The United States bombed North Korea to rubble, and they did that to prevent the unification of the peninsula under the forces that had fought the Japanese which was a vicious Japanese occupation, and they did that in support of a dictator or dictatorial regime in the South, which was composed of people who had collaborated with the Japanese. So the North Koreans have a history. They know, they have a historical memory of what it means for the United States to attack them. And that's why they're on edge all the time about this. So, you know, they're never going to stop being on edge about North Korean, South Korean, United States military exercises and military cooperation and building up forces. And now the United States is building up Japan again to be, Joe Biden vowed to make Japan a potent military force. You know, again, the Japanese occupation of Korea was vicious. So the North Koreans have a historical memory that most people in the West, you know, the Korean War was glossed over in our history, and not for them. So they remember this, and they're going to be on edge about any American military exercises in the region. And they know what's going on with China and Taiwan. They know that even NATO has said, we've got to extend our reach into the Pacific. For some reason, the Pacific's part of the North Atlantic now. So there's a world situation, and in that area too, which is on the edge of conflict. Sure. And the Americans seem to be ready for conflict everywhere, and the North Koreans are aware of that.
There's a number of points that you raised there. Before we get to those points, however, I got to find out whether we can zoom in, William Jones, on who goes first. I'm trying to figure this out based on the way things are being reported. I mentioned what's happening in the States with this tabletop exercises, but this is an exercise held where the U.S. has announced that this is being done because of a potential nuclear strike by North Korea. Okay? They're looking at it that way. But the North's posturing is one of counterattack, meaning the U.S. or its allies would attack first. Is that accurate, reading it that way? And then there's this the fact that this does not read with how each stands in terms of attacking first, because each thinks the other is going to attack first.
Well, I think that's probably they would be wary of trying to start a nuclear conflict with the United States of their own volition, since they realize there's going to be perhaps a destruction of the nation. But they must have that capability. The reason they're going with the nuclear becoming a nuclear power, effectively becoming a nuclear power, is that they feel that there's no other option open to them, that the opposition of the United States to the DPRK has been pretty straightforward through the years. The only exception was when President Trump successfully conducted negotiations with North Korea. People felt that it could be resolved diplomatically. But he was heavily criticized by the military-industrial complex while he was still president, while this was still ongoing. And then afterwards, of course, has been totally rejected by the Biden administration, which feels that only a policy of showing force, peace through strength, can make any headway with regard to the DPR. Of course, that causes the major conflict. So that they see these as the nuclear capability that they have as a capability of being able to fend off and to respond to a possible nuclear attack from the West. But they do it by showing what they can do, because words are not going to convince anybody in the U.S. military-industrial complex that North Korea is not a threat unless it shows that it is. And this is why they're very demonstrative in showing the weapons, rather than pursuing an aggressive policy. They want to show that we can respond, okay, and you should do this with some respect, and you should try and come to some kind of a negotiated position with us. But at this point, it just has not succeeded because of the tremendous opposition to the United States of diplomacy in the DPRK-U.S. relationship.
So your guess, yes or no answer, if I may ask you that, William Jones, based on how you see it, if the situation continues this way, who would strike first?
Well, I do not think that the DPRK would make any first strike unless they were significantly threatened, or they felt that they were significantly threatened.
Well, they're feeling that right now, right?
Well, that's a real question. What is the red line here? I mean, I tell you
why they're feeling that. Let me just throw this stat out there. You have all the different missile tests that have happened. I'm going to address Jim Kavanaugh with this. Jim Kavanaugh, you have all these missile tests that North Korea has executed throughout the years, and then boom, 2020. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't use that word. Then you have the year 2022, and you have 72 of them. You had 22 missile tests in a span of 3 days. I think they're feeling threatened, or they're trying to say something. What do you think? What do you make of that? And this happening during the tenure of the current U.S. President Joe Biden?
Well, I think they are trying to demonstrate that if we get hit, we can impose serious damage on those who come after us. Look, they have certain problems with this. They did demonstrate some maneuvering capabilities with these cruise missiles, but they're still saying they're not yet capable of carrying nuclear weapons. The nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles they have are still liquid fuel missiles, which means they cannot be readied very quickly. The United States knows what's happening there. If North Korea were to start fueling up their ICBMs for an attack on someone, the United States would know it. I think so, probably, because they're liquid-fueled missiles. They require preparation. They can't be easily moved around.
Why not push for some kind of diplomatic move, something, a concession maybe of some kind? I'm guessing when you have missiles that can reach the U.S. mainland, and you say that maybe it could be capable of nuclear warhead, which the reading was by the U.S., that this is a rehearsal for developing nuclear warheads or putting nuclear warheads on it, you would guess there'd be some kind of diplomatic overture. Why isn't there one?
Well, I don't think, is the American administration ready to have a diplomatic overture with North Korea? Because it doesn't want to, they could put in, this. The Korean War is still going on. There's no peace treaty.
William Jones, what do you think?
Let me get William Jones an answer on this.
I'm sorry, Jim Kavanaugh. William Jones, why not?
Nobody can say for sure what the North Korean leadership's decisions will be in this. There's a lot of erratic movement. There's a lot of irrationalism. However, I think it's quite clear to them that if they would launch a strike against the United States, or even a strike against the United States facilities like in Guam, or perhaps even a strike against Japan, there would probably be an overwhelming reaction by U.S. nuclear forces, which would essentially end the North Korean state entirely. I think there's a certain understanding of that. And therefore, I think that they would be very reticent in starting that fight. But at the same time, they want to have the capability for a variety of reasons, for defense reasons, but also in terms of the political influence that being a nuclear power has in the world, which they also want to attain. But I think short of that, I think that if they launched an attack, it would be like a hand grenade that would be set off in North Korea itself, ending the North Korean state. I don't think the North Korean leadership, as mercurial as they are, is totally insane on this issue.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right. Well, you both have mentioned Japan on a couple of occasions now, so let's look at the military defense budget. It has been raised by 26%. That's the largest. What does that mean when it comes to what Jim Kavanaugh, what you said? You said that the U.S. is going to be pumping them up with arms. First of all, does Japan want to really get in on this with the U.S.? Is Japan acting on its own free will when it comes to the way that it stands with North Korea?
Well, I think there are political factions in Japan that want to rearm, that would like Japan to become a potent military force, quote unquote, in the region again. And they are de facto, the United States is promoting that and doing that, and they will do it. Now, it's not just in relation to Korea, but it's in relation to the region as a whole. And, you know, again, it is very, the peculiarity of the North Korean situation is unique. And again, Japan's relationship with Korea is terrible. And historically, you know, I don't think they're looking to reinvade and reoccupy Korea, but they are part of the American hegemonic domination of the Pacific region. And that's what they've thrown in their lot, like Europe has thrown in its lot, Western Europe and Eastern Europe with the United States and Europe. Japanese have thrown in their lot with the Americans, and we are going to be part of your hegemonic program in the Pacific region, which means we're going to support whatever you do in China and whatever you do in North Korea.
Okay, since you mentioned China, need to ask you about that, Bill Jones. What is the relationship between China and North Korea?
The relationship is still a friendly relationship. I don't think they have control over what North Koreans do. They have some influence, but I think they're also very wary and uncertain about where that's going. They would like to have a diplomatic resolution to the nuclear issue. They do want a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. They would like to see this moving forward, but they are not the chief players there. And as long as there is no indication from the United States to achieve such a solution, they have very little they can do. The issue of North Korea, of course, is also in one sense defensive for them, because the fact that the North Koreans are there as a former ally and still a very good friend, a lot of trade relations between the two, this is also preserves a buffer in many respects against Japan in particular, which is becoming more hostile, at least in the defense area, and even South Korea, which still maintains very good relationships with China, but is also being wooed by the United States to join in some kind of alliance, perhaps of a military character, aimed against China. So the China's position is that they would like to see a stable DPRK. They would like to see some kind of diplomatic solution to this. They would use their influence, mm-hmm. I believe, if the United States were willing to move in that direction. But they do not want a military conflict on the Korean Peninsula, okay, because this would be very disastrous.
Jim Cavanaugh, I asked you about the number of missile launches that North Korea did in the year 2022, which was the most, 70, compared to the previous years. Now, there's one theory that says North Korea has upped its number of missile exercises because it's also wanting to send a message, but not of the direct kind, to the U.S., because it shows that what the U.S. intentions in the region are, aside from doing something about North Korea, is to target China. So with these exercises increasing to the point that it has, this may make the U.S. think twice about a military engagement in the region. Do you think that's the type of message that North Korea has sent to the U.S.? Does the U.S. see it that way?
Well, I'm sure the U.S. does see it that way, in the sense that the U.S. would like to know that there's no side action here that's going to come from North Korea if they get into a conflict with China, which very well might happen. And by the fact of doing all this test, and I think the main reason North Korea is doing all the testing is because it's doing a lot of development of new weapon systems, and it wants to make sure they work, and it wants to demonstrate to the world that they work. But the side effect of that is that it puts the United States in a position of having to think twice about. That's why the United States would like to get rid of this North Korean issue before they take on China in any way. I'm sure they'd like to do that, like they want to get rid of Syria and Iran, you know. Syria and Libya before they take on Iran. So there's a lot of things going on in that respect. But, you know, the main reason the North Koreans are doing it, I think, is because they want to develop their systems, and they need to develop their systems, which aren't completely developed. And the United States does need to worry, at least, you know, what we have to take account if we're going to have military action with China. Will the North Koreans come in, and will their missiles be part of the package that we have to deal with in such a conflict?
All right. Final question. Unfortunately, I have so many, but final question, Bill Jones, goes to you. This is an odd request, to say the least, when the U.S. holds China responsible for North Korea's multiple missile launches. It's even asked China and Russia to pressure North Korea to stop. I mean, really? Do you think that the U.S. even... Well, I mean, hey, you got to give it to the U.S. You know, they're asking what they cite as a number one and two national security threats to please do us a favor and stop North Korea from launching these missiles. How do you view that U.S. request from both China and Russia? In under a minute, please.
Well, why would they help the United States in any sense in this issue, when Russia, of course, is under attack by the United States, and where China has been a target of hostility from the U.S., in which the Taiwan issue is now being played with. It's not a situation in which you have a whole lot of trust between these countries.
Okay.
In other circumstances, perhaps there would be cooperation if you're working towards like a security architecture in the Asia Pacific. They would work together. But to the extent that the U.S. has named Russia an enemy and also China as an enemy, you're not going to get too many favors out of them.
Indeed. Thank you very much for that. William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg. Jim Kavanaugh, political analyst and blogger from New York. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitahui and the team, it's goodbye.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Allazina yastami'una al-qawl. Those who listen to what is said. Fayattabi'una ahsana. And follow the best of it. Ulaika allazina hadahum Allah. These are the ones whom Allah has guided. وَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمْ أُولُو الْأَلْبَابِ. And those have been endowed with intellects. Well, that's what we do in this program. We have a roundtable discussion. We listen to what is said. We actually select the best of it. And today, we are going to have this roundtable discussion with two special guests. I have Brother Muhammad with me.
Assalamu alaikum,
brother. And you're listening to two Zainabs. This is Zainab Askari, and we have Sister Zainab Sadat Musavi here. Assalamu alaikum
wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, I'm so happy to be with you, Sister Zainab, and you, Brother Muhammad. It's my pleasure.
Thank you so much. Our pleasure to be with you. So, Sister Zainab Musavi Sadat, Zainab Sadat Musavi, in order to not to have the confusion.
Sister Musavi?
We will call you as Zainab, Sister Musavi.
Yes, I'm
all right. I'm Sister Zainab, to Sister Musavi. Right. So, let's get into something interesting. And what do you think we should be discussing? I think life has taught me a lot over here. And when I came to Iran, I actually wanted to go back to time and I wanted to rewind my life and live it again. Has that happened with you ever, Brother Muhammad?
Oh, yeah, of course. You see, I think the main topic would be here is what do you do when you're regretful? Or do you want to relive your life after so many regrets? Or we can even look at it in a positive way. You've been through so many good things. You want to relive those good things once again, good memories, whatever it is. This reliving is something that apparently I think everybody has this tendency of, right? We kind of want to live back again. And that's why in the Quran, we have this ayah of after death, People wish that they had returned back to this life and they've done good. Even in the Day of Judgment, they say, I wish that... That's why one of the titles of the Day of Judgment is Yawm al-Hasra, the Day of Regret. They want to come back and do good things in this life. Personally speaking, I've had so many moments that I've messed up from the childhood until now. I'd be like, oh, I wish I'd get back there. I would have done it the best. Yeah, that's something that I think everybody has this tendency of. And I believe that God has opened up ways for this. God has opened up ways for a living. And we, especially for example, let's take for example Hajj. We say that once a person goes to Hajj and he returns back, it's as if
a newborn
person. All the sins have been forgiven. Of course, that Hajj has to be a Hajj, not a Hajj of entertainment, but a Hajj, real Hajj. Person goes to Hajj, comes back, he relives. He's as if a newborn child.
Yeah. So what about you, Sister Musavi?
Well, I think that might be strange for you, but I think I don't want to live my life again
because it seems strange.
You know, I personally think that I have made my choices and I tried my best throughout my life to be a good person, to do choices, to make choices that do not make me feel regretful in the future.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
When I say I don't want to go back, I mean that I want to be realistic and try to learn from my mistakes. And of course, I made another point that even if I have tried my best and even if I was the best person I could, when it comes to the end of my time, when I come nearer to my death, I would realize that there were moments when I could do even better and better. And that is the regret, which is precious for me. You know, there are lots of...
She reminds me of Imam Ali Lisan, who says that live your life the way as if you're going to die tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, and
His hadith continues. I think it's a bigger hadith. It says, "Kun fi dunyaka ka'annaka tu'ishu fiha," but deal with the worldly affairs as if you're going to live forever.
Forever, yeah.
Yeah. So and if something happens today, a calamity befalls you, it's okay. There is tomorrow. There is the after tomorrow. Don't be worryful about if you're, for example, your program, your schedule didn't fit today. It's okay. There is tomorrow. It's a worldly thing. But then, "Kun fi akhiratika ka'annaka tamut ghada."
Yes.
Be with your spiritual and your hereafter deeds as if you're going to die tomorrow.
Exactly.
If you've missed your prayer, do the qadha right now. You're going to die tomorrow.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It's a very beautiful hadith of Imam Ali.
Yes. And that's the point. And there are lots
Thank you for completing it. Yeah. Yes, sister.
Yes, and there are lots of verses in the Holy Book of Quran saying, warning us that you must be careful, you must take that in your mind that you can be better. There are lots of conversations in the Holy Book of Quran between those people in Gehenna, in Jahannam, saying to the angels, to the special angels, that I want to go back and live my life again. You know, in case of those people, the angels would respond to them that you are not allowed to go back because in case you go back, you would repeat your life the way just you lived it. But about doing good, I think that's another case. As I said, when you are good, you are, inshallah, of those who go to heaven. And when you go to heaven, you can see that there are lots of levels. There's seven levels
in heaven.
And when you...
I wish I could be among the sabiqoon as-sabiqoon.
Yes, and in each level when you go, you wish that you would have done better actions and you would take advantage of your life more and more in order to elevate in those levels. I think it's quite important for we as Muslims.
Yeah. She also reminded me of one of the things when you were talking about those who will be in the hell and they will be saying this and that. And it reminded me of one of the verses from Surah Furqan, which says that on that day, people will be crying from the hellfire that I wish I had not chosen that particular person as my Khalil, so brother.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
As my friend.
Yes,
I had not chosen that particular person as my friend. I do regret on that note because not everyone was worth of my friendship. So what about you?
When it comes to friendship and the interactions I have with people, alhamdulillah, I think it was a mercy from God that most of my life I had people who were at least good. You see, you know, there is this tendency of mankind. You try to make friends who are close to yourself, like who have the same characteristics as you. Like in a class, you'd find at least two or three friends, a group of friends
are similar to you.
They're similar to you, right?
Yes.
Alhamdulillah, when I look at my previous life with my friendship circle, I find people, at least compared to the other friendship circles, they were closer to me and they were less regretful than how I would see others. I would think sometimes like, oh, imagine if I would have been friends with Fulan, like I would have been, you know, somewhere else now.
Yeah.
But then alhamdulillah, I had friends who would in most cases enjoin me in good. I can remember once I had an issue with my teacher who gave me zero in high school. And he gave me zero not out of justice, because I did some mischief in the class.
So you'll be saying from Jannah now, I wish that particular teacher was not my teacher.
Maybe, yeah. But then he was a good teacher. He wasn't all that a bad teacher. But then I did some mischief.
See,
he's
so respectful.
What happened is we had planned something for him. I wouldn't say what, but then one of my friends, he reached out. He's like, look, we understand.
I'll pull his chair.
Yeah, just don't pull. That's like a silly thing. We had something even worse we had in mind. He was like, no, just, you know, it's your own fault. Just think about it. It's going to be solved and stuff. And it was...
So when you actually wanted to teach a lesson to your own teacher, then your friend, so one of your friends from your friend circle comes and tells you, relook on your actions.
Exactly, exactly.
It's not
so different. For my friends, I see, alhamdulillah, most of them, they've been good. And I tried my best to be good to them as well. There have been cases. So when it comes to friendship, but then again, there have been instances where you'd say, okay, at least for this particular time, I wish I'd have come back. Like, if they're disrespecting the teachers, I see that as a very heavy thing now, especially after coming to the Hausa. You see how it's a completely different environment. You see, everything becomes respectful, not only your teachers, your friends, it's the utmost level of respect. Now that you think about it, you're like, oh, I wish I'd returned. Though I was relatively respectful for my teachers, I wish I had returned. I'd been more respectful. With the definition of respect I know now, at least I would have been better at that time, at least.
Yeah. Well, let's take a short break and come back and we'll continue our discussion. Welcome back. You're listening to the Back to Reality, and I have with me Sister Musawi and Brother Muhammad. And the topic is, what if we go back to our life and live again? Brother Muhammad and me, we want to live again, although we have learned a lot, and he has had a religious background from the very beginning. He has had very good friends from the very beginning, but still he wants to go back and live back. And I have all messed up my life, but still, yeah, of course, I want to go back. But Sister,
it's a two-way thing, right? You want to cherish the good memories once again, and you also want to, you know, kind of reimburse the bad memories.
Yeah, unfortunately for me, like as we were talking about friends, our friends would actually encourage us doing the things that under the pretext of being bold, like whatever they would, like Imam Ali Al-Ghassam also says that if you listen to a sinner, he would actually, or if you be in a company of a sinner, he would actually make sins look very beautiful in front of you. So
exactly.
In our time, the girls would like actually tell you, if you're not bold, you won't be able to do this. If you are not doing this, basically, you don't have guts to do that. So but alhamdulillah, I never went into the things that they went into. I had been actually seeing those things. So I actually don't want to be friends with some of the friends. I want to be friends with some of my friends. Exactly that, the way I said, I don't want to say yes to everyone around. There are many more things that I have learned from life. Like there was a verse which says that, what is it that has made you ungrateful towards your Lord? And when it used the word Rabb, the Lord, and I got into the meaning of what is Rabb, the one who gave you name, who actually brought you up like your parents, who gave you everything, whatever you have today. And towards that Lord, what is it that made you ungrateful towards your Lord? And the verse is, مَا غَرَّقَ بِرَبِّكَ الْكَرِيمِ the Lord who actually has brought you in a very Kareem way, in a very, you know, kind, the most...
Noblest of ways.
Exactly. Yeah. So towards that, Lord, you had been, what distracted you actually from him? So there were many things that actually distracted us from the Lord, and that's the effect of media, the effect of culture you're living in, the impact of friends, the peer pressure, and all those things. So having all this knowledge that I have today, I want to definitely turn back time and live those memories once again, but with the knowledge that I have right now. So yes, Sister Musavi, you tell us something more.
Well, for closing, I want to refer to a beautiful hadith from our dear Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which is about the topic we're talking about. In that regard, he says, take advantage of five before five. Your youth before your old age, your health before your sickness, your wealth before your poverty, your free time before your business, and your life before your death. Really beautiful. You should take advantage of your life. It doesn't mean that you don't need to look back. What I said, in fact, I don't need to look back at my life, but the point is that I must take advantage of my life.
Though it's literally impossible for us to go back in life and relive the memories or relive the different aspects that we want to, but I think, as Sister Musa, we mentioned and shocked us, it's important that we consider the life ahead.
Yeah.
Use the past as the lessons and kind of configure the present so that our future is most prosperous.
Yeah, most of us want to go back because we have a kind of, we feel that Allah will not forgive us for the things that we have done or the way we have messed up our life. But Allah is far more actually Rahman, Rahim, kind, generous. He's more, much more than that, what we think like. And He accepts the tawbah, He accepts our apologies. So it's time to say our sorries to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, apologize in front of Him. And what is important is not to get back, as Sister Musavi constantly repeated in the session. So it's important that we don't get back into those things and learn from our mistakes. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much, guys, for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
For most people in Gaza, it's just a dream to travel and explore the world outside the Israeli cruel blockade.
The new generation has lived almost all its whole life under the Israeli siege, learning about the world only through screens. The longest-standing Israeli restriction on the movement of people and goods to and from Gaza has undermined the living conditions of over 2 million Palestinian residents.
The idea of this festival is that children of Gaza rarely travel abroad, and it's hard to get out of Gaza to discover the countries around the world. We sought to bring the world's countries to our children and introduce to different cultures through a collection of famous Flint statues, food and clothes, cultures in general.
Al-Amal Institute for Orphans in Gaza is an independent non-governmental organization that pursues to bring about positive change in the culture of the community and raise awareness about the orphans and their needs in order to ensure a better life for them and their families.
Yahala from around the world comes as a message to the whole world that Palestine is also part of the world. Therefore, this message reaches the world that the crossings should be open to facilitate traveling for our children and us, so we can visit these countries and communicate widely with the neighboring and other countries.
The Israeli blockade of the occupied Gaza Strip in its current form has been in place since June 27, when Israel imposed a full-scale land, sea, and air blockade on the area. The siege contravenes Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits collective punishment that prevents the realization of a broad range of human rights. Three Gaza children died in 2022 as a result of the Israeli occupation authorities' delays or refusal to grant them permits to exit Gaza for medical treatment.
We hope such event has a positive effect on our students, and they are part of the history and the glory, and they are capable of breaking the siege and the Israeli blockade want to break their will. They have a great civilization, and this affects their psychological and social well-being.
The beleaguered Palestinians in Gaza live in a cycle of a struggle, located, imprisoned, and denied basic human rights and needs. Now entering its 18th year, the Israeli blockade created a generation seeing a window to the world outside. These kinds of events are a glimmer of hope for the children who one day want to break the siege and restore their right to freedom of movement. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
Terrorism laundering, a term which Iran's foreign minister's two-day visit to Geneva will be remembered by. Addressing the 52nd session of the Human Rights Council at the UN headquarters, Hossein Amir Abdullahian did not mince his words when it came to elaborating on the fact that Iran had been a victim of an unprecedented propaganda war. He said the rights of the Iranian nation were completely ignored during that war, launched by the same countries claiming to be advocates of human rights.
The role of anti-Iran terrorist groups in the recent crisis in my country was evident. Some states were involved in terrorism laundering while applying double standard. They provided considerable financial and logistical facility to some violent and terrorist elements during the unrest. The UN human rights mechanisms could and should contribute to the promotion and protection of human rights through genuine dialogue, constructive interaction, and respectful capacity building cooperation.
Some European officials in particular, who then took the opportunity to meet with Amir Abdullahian. Several other meetings followed as well, involving officials from countries including Armenia, Indonesia, Senegal, and Venezuela, seeking stronger bilateral ties. Top UN officials also met with Iran's foreign minister, including Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Boosting cooperation was the key issue in the agenda of this pentilateral meeting. Iran is hosting over 5 million Afghan refugees, but international humanitarian organizations have not been offering any kind of help. On the other hand, unilateral sanctions have also exacerbated the situation of these Afghan refugees. The next session of this pentilateral meeting will be held in Tehran to discuss the situation further.
The UN Secretary General was informed of the efforts that Iran has made to solve the problems in Yemen, and Mr. Guterres demanded that we continue our efforts. Regarding Ukraine, Iran's stance was clarified. Iran is ready to use its potential for initiating a peace process. Iran's cooperation with the IAEA and the upcoming visit of the agency's delegation was also discussed in the meeting.
An issue that was reiterated by the foreign minister during the 2023 conference on disarmament, which started on the same day the 22nd session of the Human Rights Council was held, allowing the issue of human rights to be discussed in more detail.
We have several agenda items. We have more than 40 or 50 themes and around the same number of country situations that will be discussed over the course of this session. It is also a sign of the importance, I would say, that states and NGOs attach to the Human Rights Council as a venue to discuss issues which are often not heard in other venues. So it's incredibly significant.
This year marks 75 years since the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and 30 years since the adoption of the Vienna Declaration, two milestone documents that continue to guide the work of the Council. But it is very clear that we still have a long way to go.
The 52nd session of the Human Rights Council started on February 27th and will continue until April the 4th. Key issues on the agenda include the three Ps: promotion, protection, and prevention. Promotion of human rights, protection of those who fight for human rights, and preventing human rights from being violated. Gisu Misha Ahmadi, the Human Rights Headquarters in Geneva.
Years after Brexit, they're still talking about it. One big sticking point, the post-Brexit Northern Ireland Protocol for Trade, legislation that at one point threatened the Good Friday Peace Agreement and pushed the EU and UK to the brink of a trade war. Officials on both sides of the dispute now claim they have found a solution to the problem, and they have a name for it too.
The Windsor Framework delivers free-flowing trade within the whole United Kingdom. It protects Northern Ireland's place in our union, and it safeguards sovereignty for the people of Northern Ireland.
Under the new deal, there will be two routes for goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. A green route with minimal checks for goods, which will stay in Northern Ireland, and a red one for goods which may continue into the EU after going through EU checks. Disputes will be settled by Northern Ireland courts, but some could still go to the European Court of Justice. And if new EU single market regulations are introduced, the UK government could veto them if the Northern Ireland Assembly has voted for that to happen.
We are now seeing part of the United Kingdom, namely the north of Ireland, essentially being re-invited back into aspects of the EU. And that is a very big statement. And I'm sure that Brussels is hoping this will begin to disintegrate the overall Brexit deal.
The details of the deal are yet to emerge, but Prime Minister Sunak faces two challenges. One is to get the approval of the Democratic Unionists in Northern Ireland, who have refused to enter a power-sharing government with Sinn Féin nationalists for months over the Boris Johnson-era protocol, which has created a sea border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK.
The Unionists have a set of tests that have to be passed or they'll back out of it. Now, that's an insurance policy. They don't want to lose votes. They don't want to look like they've sold out the Unionist agenda. And that makes political sense for them. The big test for Sunak, more than anything else, is whether he can get all sides to give a tick in the box.
In Westminster, meantime, the Prime Minister has briefed his cabinet, who seem to be on side.
The Prime Minister's next challenge would be winning the approval of the Eurosceptic Conservative members of the ERG, the European Research Group in the building behind me, who have already said that the revised bill does not go far enough, which means that the deal is not quite done yet. Saeed Bourza, London.
The indefinite strike, which began nationwide on January 4th in protest at the Dina Boluarte administration, remains strong in the southern regions of Peru, with major road closures in several provinces, according to the Ground Transport Authority. Nearly all of the civilians that have been reported killed since the December 7th ouster of President Castillo lost their lives in anti-government protests in this part of the country.
It's mainly the people in the countryside who are mistreated. We cry daily for our sons who have been killed, as many as 70 people, by this government, and they still haven't acknowledged that they did it. They haven't said who was killed.
A newly released Ipsos poll finds that nationally, 51% of Peruvians believe that Pedro Castillo was ousted in a parliamentary coup, a number which surges to 69% in rural areas like here in the Puno region.
Particularly in Puno, they have marginalized us a lot. They have said that we are terrorists, that we are vandals, and that we are just Indians. We are going to continue fighting. I believe the strike will continue until Dina Boluarte resigns, as well as the rest of the Congress.
A preliminary report released this week by the International Human Rights and Solidarity Mission outlines numerous human rights abuses and calls for an investigation of the Peruvian state for crimes against humanity, for its excessive use of force against a defenseless civilian population and using lethal weapons.
I want justice to be served and for the whole world to find out everything that we are going through here. I want everyone to know so that there is justice for our children who have died.
Around the country, the popular call continues to be the demand for the resignation of Dina Boluarte, as well as immediate presidential elections. Camila Escalante, Desaguadero.
Consumer Association Federconsumatori has rung the alarm bell over the growing financial difficulties Italian families are faced with. Federconsumatori National Observatory has found that one out of four families in Italy is struggling to cope with high inflation and rising cost of living. This, as the Bureau of Statistics Istat has estimated, a timid comeback in consumer confidence in February. According to Federconsumatori, an increasing number of Italians are giving up on food quality to save money.
Today, as the cost of living crisis has eroded families' purchasing power, we have recorded a 17% drop in the purchase of meat and fish and a 13% drop in the consumption of fruit and vegetables. We had asked the government to introduce significant supporting measures for the Italian families, but unfortunately our calls went utterly unheard.
Prices in Italy rose more than 8% year on year in 2022, jumping to its highest 12-month gain in nearly 40 years when the lira currency was in use. According to Istat, Italy's annual inflation rate registered a slowdown in January, dropping to 10% from 11.6% in December. However, the situation has turned dire for many in the country.
The cost of living went up big way, too much for a young student like me. Prices have doubled over the past months.
The cost of staple food items, basic ingredients, has gone crazy, and also the cost of energy. To me, it's a theft by the government.
According to analysts, high energy prices have been the main drivers for the bulk of those increases, pushed higher by the energy supply challenges that followed the Ukraine-Russia war. The poverty rate increased significantly in Italy in 2020-2022 period. In 2021, some 2 million families lived in absolute poverty, a figure accounting for over 5.5 million people that is destined to grow. Max Civili, Rome.
Egypt's foreign minister Sameh Shoukry has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. In the meeting, the top diplomat conveyed Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's message of solidarity to Assad and all Syrians affected by the recent earthquakes. He also expressed Cairo's keenness on bolstering historic relations between Syria and Egypt, as well as boosting joint cooperation. Assad, for his part, thanked Egypt for sending humanitarian assistance, asserting that improving bilateral ties among Arab states constitute the foundation for improving the situation in general in the Arab world. Shoukry stressed that Egypt-Syria relations are a basic factor in the security of Arab countries. He also reiterated his country's support for Syria.
Egypt has offered so far 1,500 tons of assistance and will continue to provide all humanitarian assistance needed. Relations between both nations are strong. Egypt supports Syria in facing challenges. We hope Syria overcomes the repercussions of the earthquakes as soon as possible.
Shoukry also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, in which Faisal al-Maqdad briefed him on the steps taken by the Syrian government for helping Syrians affected by the earthquakes. Al-Miqdad also thanked Egypt for its unwavering aid to Syrians since day one of the earthquakes.
We welcome Egypt's foreign minister, who is visiting his home, people and country. His talks with President Assad focused on the results of the earthquakes and the historic relations between both countries. Egypt played a significant role in assisting Syrians following the earthquakes.
The visit comes a day after a historic trip by several senior lawmakers of Arab parliaments to Damascus, who affirmed they will push their governments for restoring relations with Syria. That's amid an increase in such moves by Arab states. This is the first visit for an Egyptian foreign minister to Syria since the start of the crisis in 2011. It's a clear indication of Egypt's serious intention to gradually restore normal ties with the Arab country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Tomatoes, one of your five a day. Supermarket giants in the UK are now only allowing three of these and other salad ingredients to their customers. And where there is availability, you'll have to pay a premium, especially when it comes to out-of-season fresh produce. Here is why.
Starting with climate change, 2022 was the second hottest year in Europe. Heat waves and extreme temperatures in Spain, one of Europe's biggest food producers, have meant fewer crops to harvest. The same problem with supplying countries such as Morocco in North Africa. But the UK has its own well-established food industry. One important component of it, greenhouses, many hectares of which now lay barren.
There is a problem, of course, with the high price of gas that is used to heat up these greenhouses. They do require quite a lot of gas input, and that's quite expensive. And the problem is that the supermarkets are also being very tough on pricing. So it's not easy to then raise your prices and get what you want from the supermarkets. And so rather than produce anything at a loss, some producers have obviously decided not to produce at all.
And the UK faces another particular issue. Most of its fruit and veg come from the European Union. The country's exit from the bloc has meant extra costs and bureaucracy added to the strain, especially on the supply of perishable goods.
Brexit has caused a shortage of labour, and a shortage of labour means a shortage of fruit and vegetables at the end of the day. More bureaucracy, and more bureaucracy means more costs, and more costs mean less profits, and therefore lower UK production. It's as simple as that.
The solution, food-producing organisations say, is for the government to provide more support, such as replacing high-carbon fertilizers with low-carbon alternatives, or investing more in soil-free indoor growing techniques, such as vertical farming. Saeed Purza, London.
The first memorial of martyrs of resistance media, entitled Narrators of Resistance, has been held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. The families of media martyrs from Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, Palestine, and Lebanon attended the event. Addressing the ceremony, the commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Quds Force, Brigadier General Ismail Ghani, praised the martyrs of resistance media as a treasure which must be well invested.
The media presence of our martyrs makes them convey the sublime values that led them to achieve the goal of martyrdom. The global arrogance led by the U.S. promotes that those who own money and the biggest weapons are to emerge victorious in wars. However, despite its limited capabilities, the media of the resistance front succeeded in conveying the voice of truth.
Moreover, speaking at the event, head of the IRIB, Dr. Jebeli, honored the media martyrs on the resistance front.
In hard war, the enemy seeks to destroy our fortifications and force us to retreat from one place to another. But in soft war, the enemy does not use weapons, bombardment, and physically does not seek to push us back from one area to another, but seeks to mislead us, change our thinking, distort reality, and take us away from the straight path. We proudly pay for our resistance, but I would like to say that resistance not only costs nothing, but is a total investment. The participants believe that along with the war launched against the axis of resistance in the military sphere, the U.S. and the Zionist regime have also been using all means in the media sphere to undermine the resistance.
The participants believe that along with the war launched against the axis of resistance in the military sphere, the U.S. and the Zionist regime have also been using all means in the media sphere to undermine the resistance. Journalists of resistance media, as the narrators of resistance and truth, shed light on the realities on the ground in conflict zones, the realities which have been repeatedly ignored by mainstream media outlets of the West.